Good morning and welcome back to Nachyami. Today we're going to be learning Ezra Perek Vav, the sixth chapter in the book of Ezra. It is 22 psukim long, and it is really following up on the story which has already started. At this point in time, there's been a rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash a number of years later, under the auspices of Zerubbabel, with the encouragement of Zechariah and Haggai, and the neighbors, or the governors of the beyond the river area, which is assumed to be Syria, Tatanai and Shtarbat Boznai, send a letter to Artaxerxes. They send a letter to Darius asking, is this in fact the case? Are they allowed to please do the research? So our perek is now about the research which is done. So in the first five psukim, the Tanakh describes to us that Darius commands to check the annals, and he found a parchment in the capital of Media, which is a place called Achmesa, which is red. And in the first year of, this is what it says, the first year of Cyrus, he sent out an order regarding the temple in Yerushalayim, saying it should be built as a place for sacrifice, and the base will be built, it will be 60 amos high and 60 amos wide, and with a row of wood, every three rows of stone, and the expenses will be covered by the palace. The gold and the silver and the vessels of the Mikdash, which were taken by Nebuchadnezzar, should be returned to the house of Hashem. So this document obviously corroborates the idea that, in fact, there was a Persian king who gave the go-ahead. For a few questions to think about before going further, and that is, why is it so hard to find this information? We're not dealing with an extraordinarily length of time later. Why is it so difficult to find out what Cyrus said? Why are they going and searching in Achmesa? What's the whole business here? The Malbim explains that there was a shift in the capital city of Persia. At the beginning, Persia conquered Babylon, and therefore their seat of power was in Babylon and in Media. But what happened was that after Ahasuerus took rule, he shifted the place of power, the capital city, to Susa, to Shushan. That being the case, in order to be able to locate the documents of Cyrus, who was in the called first tier of leadership, then it is important they have to go back to the annals of the other place. The Malbim does also suggest, based on the timeline of Chazal, that Ahasuerus and the whole Purim story happened before this, in between the first round of building and the second round of building. That being the case, then it would be potentially possible that there were people who were not interested in this edict being proliferated, people like of the likes of Haman. So there were many anti-Semites who may have got rid of the original letters and the edicts of Cyrus, so it could not be found. So it took a lot of searching, and they had to go back to the ancient archives of Achmesa in order to be able to find it, because it was not in the regular office, not in the regular filing cabinet. Just a perspective over here. Why is the palace paying for the expenses? Like, why would the Persian government pay for this? So Dayat Mikra points out, it's not that the king's saying, I'm opening my coffers. What he's saying is that I'm going to allocate some of the taxes, some of the local taxes, and as opposed to just going towards the mail system, it's also going to go to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Right? So you're shouldering it, but it's not going to come from private funding. Then the question is, why? What's this business about the wood? Like, why is it important that in the decree he mentioned that there's wood every three lines of bricks? I mean, that's a very, interesting and architectural detail, but is that really significant to us to know? The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Daf Daled Amud Aleph tells us that perhaps Cyrus had nefarious intent. Perhaps Cyrus was interested in having a way out, lest this become a bastion of rebellion. So what he does is he ensures that there is going to be wood in and amongst the bricks, in the case that he needs to incinerate, in case that he needs to set fire to the temple, it'll be easier to catch flame if the need be. So it's almost like he's putting a ripcord into this project in order to pull God if he feels that this would be a danger to him. Then we move to the next few psukim, psukim Vav to Yud Beis, 6 to 12, in which we now hear about the command that Darius gives to help with building the Mikdash. So this is a pretty amazing document that we're about to hear. It is still in Aramaic at this point in time, as the beginning of the Perek was. And Darius sends a letter to Tatanai and Shtar Boznai, and he requests that they step away and they leave the area alone. They do not halt or stop the building process. He tells them to let the Jews continue building the Mikdash, and then he says, but they will need your help by allocating taxes from beyond the river for the building project. So they are the local government. Is actually the seat of, we'll call it the county or the province, is in beyond the river, so that's probably the area of Syria. But they are going to be the ones allocating the taxes to building this Beis HaMikdash. But not only that, he goes so far as to say that the supplies will be supplied from the taxes, whether it be bulls, rams, or burnt offering, wheat, salt, wine, and oil for the Kohanim. Why? So they can serve the Beis HaMikdash, and they can pray for the king and his sons, meaning to say himself and his dynasty. Anyone who removes, he says, a beam, just a beam from the Beis HaMikdash will be impaled upon it and his house confiscated. And he says explicitly that Hashem, that the God who established his name on this place, bring the downfall of any of the kings or nations who attempt to destroy it or undermine the house of Hashem in Yerushalayim. This is a pretty remarkable letter to read. Just a few points over here is, why does he add on that the sacrifice will be paid for the people beyond the river, folks? Like, why is he doing that? It sounds like he is extending Cyrus's decree. Cyrus had said that there would be an allocation of taxes for the building. Darius is saying that there'll be an allocation of the taxes for the upkeep, which is a much more incredible idea as well. Let me say, we all know that it's very exciting to dedicate to new buildings, but upkeep is not quite as exciting. He's saying the upkeep is also coming from an allocation of taxes, which is a remarkable thing. Why does he ask for the prayers? So the Gemara in Bava Basra points out that there was, you know, still as you know, as well intended as he still is self centered. And the Gemara in Bava Basra, Yonah Mabez, describes that, you know, there's a certain sense of narcissism which is involved here, which is why he's making sure that the building is going to, in fact, be to serve himself, to as a self serving point. We move to Psukim Yud Gimel to Tesvav, in which we're told in Aramaic about the completion of the Beis HaMikdash. Tatanai Shas Boshash Shtar Boznai fulfilled the king's mandate. The Jews succeeded in finishing the building, and they're urged on by Haggai and Zechariah and the aegis of Rav Hashem and the commanders Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. The Mikdash was completed on the 3rd of Adar in the 6th year of Darius, so we're talking about just under a 4-year period it took to build this autumn, accumulating all the materials as well. One question that we should ask ourselves is this a miracle? Meaning to say, is this whole episode, this letter, is this all a miracle? The Malbim says, no, it's a natural miracle. Hashkocha mu'utefes b'teva, he calls it. It is Hashem's providence wrapped in the natural world. And that's important because this is going to be the modality of operation of Hashem from there on inwards till our time now. We're seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's not splitting the earth and the Mikdash emerges out of the earth. He is not beating down Darius. Darius has his own interests. But Darius sends a letter and a note and his own interests converge with what's going on over here. That's really important to appreciate in terms of the way that things are working differently. Who is the Artaxerxes who's mentioned here? It says Cyrus, Koresh, Daryavesh, Darius, and Artaxerxes. Who is that? Mitzvotus points out, as we know before, Artaxerxes is the default name for a Persian king, like Pharaoh is the name for Egyptians, which means, as Rashi extends this, that it's referring to Darius II, because it was only Cyrus and Darius who are the ones who wrote these letters, according to the way that we're looking at it right now. The Maon does point out that Chazal do say that they converge, that these are all the same person, Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. It's very hard to understand what that means historically, but he quotes the Razarachia Halevi, that's the Baal HaMa'or, who says that it's very clear that these are three separate people, and he says that it's very clear as well that there's a greater amount of time in the way that Chazal's timeline works, but we don't really fully understand this, which again relates to the general topic of dating, which itself is a discussion as to how you understand the dating of Chazal compared to the dating of the Persian kings, which is slightly different as well. We move to Psukim Tes Zayin to Yud Ches, and in this section we hear about the dedication of the Mikdash. In this we hear about the Yisraelim, the Kohanim, the Levim, and it says the Bnei Agola, the children of the diaspora, all celebrated the consecration of the house of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it describes it was a sacrificial dedication. 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, 12 goats as sin offerings for each tribe, and they appointed the Kohanim and the Levim to specific times for service as prescribed in the Torah. Remarkable. What were the Korbanos Chatos for? Why were they bringing in Korban Chatos? So Mitzvotus points out because not everybody returned. So they brought a Korban Chatos for those Jews who not yet returned. Most of them, unfortunately, quote the Gemara in Horios that describes that this, of course, was a Horaos Shah. This was an edict of the hour because you're not allowed to bring a Korban Chatos, a sin offering, as a dedication, as a voluntary offering. But here they are doing it because, so to speak, to capture the idea that the people yet have not fully returned. Now, in the Bnei Agola over here, it sounds like, we'll get to it in a second, but it sounds like as we learn and move to the next section, it's important to appreciate who these people are. We finally go to the last section of this parak, which is Yud Tes to Chof Beis, in which we hear about the bringing of the Korban Pesach. We notice a switch into Hebrew here, and we describe how the Bnei Agola bring a Pesach on the 14th of the month of Nisan, which makes sense because the Beis HaMikdash was dedicated in Adar, and then the first festival they're going to be encountering is in fact Pesach. And it describes how everybody is pure, the Kohanim are pure, the Levim are pure, and they sacrifice the Korban Pesach on behalf of the Bnei HaGola and the Kohanim themselves. And it describes everybody over there who come in, the Jews, the converts, who'd separated themselves from the Goy Ha'aretz, Goyei Ha'aretz, from the nations of the earth, to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They made this most beautiful and joyous Chag HaPesach. Why? It was Kisimchom Hashem, because Hashem made them happy. And then at the end, it gives a curious description how Hashem turned the heart of the king of Assyria to strengthen their hands. Few basic questions. Why the switch to Hebrew in this last section of the parak? Everything was adapted to Aramaic for the last few sections. Why is it Hebrew now? Rav Schwab says it because it might indicate a time lapse. And Rav Schwab himself had an essay describing and trying to work out the chronology of the period. He recanted from that, but in his initial suggestion, he suggests that maybe there was a gap of time between the earlier section in Aramaic and this section now in Hebrew, and to indicate that Tanakh gives us a shift in language. But potentially, it seems that this is because it's movement from a Golus Dikah perspective. They were still in exile in the land of Israel. They hadn't yet finished building the Beis HaMikdash. The degree that now they're able to make their own Beis HaMikdash, they have sovereignty, the king's supporting them and making the surrounding nations support them, is an element of Geula, and the language change might be expressing that itself. Hu Bnei Agola does not refer to the people in Babylon. It refers to the people in Babylon and Persia who had made Aliyah. So it's referring to those who are there. One would imagine that there must have been people who came in, but Tanakh does not seem to give us an indication as to how many made Aliyah or came for this first Korban Pesach. You can imagine that there must have been a great feeling of having missed out for those who did not pack their belongings and come and are sitting there reading the local papers, hearing about HaKadosh Baruch Hu has returned and the Korban Pesach. Must have been a very disappointing experience from them, but which I'm sure took no doubt very little time for them to rationalize or hopefully make a difference in their lives and come or to contribute. So it's really interesting to think about that dynamic as well. The last pasuk, of course, is very curious. Why is the king of Assyria being told, he's convincing, what has that got to do with anything? Assyria was destroyed by Babylon, which was destroyed by Persia. So what's Assyria got to do with this? So all the Mephoreshim say this refers to Darius, the king of Babylon. It's just, that's Assyria was captured by Babylon, which was captured by Persia. So it's in a way of describing him. To me, it seems obvious that as the Malbim points out, that it's referring to the beyond the river tribes like Tatanai and Shtar Boznai, who are in the area of Assyria, who are now forced by the king of Persia to support the Beis HaMikdash and are no longer able to exercise power like the Tzarei Yehuda of yesteryear. And that's what's being emphasized now, which is part of the reason why, because there's peace on the northern border, now they can get on with their religious service and really serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Beis HaMikdash. That's what's being described over here. It also might be that there's a reference and parallel to the times of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, where there was a momentous time where Chizkiyahu HaMelech was able to bring the Korban Pesach, and at such time, the king at that time was, or the kingdom was Assyria, so there might be the Tanakh is trying to also indicate that these two events are connected. With this, we close. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.